All participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference call, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call may be recorded. I would now like to have the conference over to Mr. Peter Berg with Great Lakes ADA Center.
All right. Thank you very much, Saeed. And welcome to everyone. Happy New Year as we are entering into our first ADA audio conference of the 2013 calendar year. The ADA audio conference series is a project of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is the premier leader in providing information on the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Education National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research, NIDRR. So we want to welcome the folks, all of you that are joining us today by telephone, through our webinar platform, either using the audio streaming or using the captioning features in the webinar room. Just want to quickly go over a couple of items for those of you that are participating and joining us in the webinar room. To access the captioning feature within the webinar room, you can click on the captioning icon or use the keystroke function control F8, and you can size the captioning window to meet your specific needs. To submit questions for those of you on the telephone, when we get to the question and answer portion of today's session, we'll bring Saeed back and he will give instructions on how you can ask questions. For those of you in the webinar room, you want to go to the participant list and you want to highlight the Great Lakes highlight Great Lakes in the participant list and right-click, and you will see the ability to send a private message. That private message will be sent to all of the moderators, and then we will get those questions to Michael when we get to that section. For those of you using assistive technology, a little different way to get there, use the function key 6, F6, and until you get to the participant list. Once you get to the participant list, you want to use the arrow to arrow up and down that list again until you find the Great Lakes participant. Right-click on Great Lakes, and then you'll see the ability to send a private message that will go to the presenters. You also have the, for those of you, again, in the webinar room, you have the ability to access or to customize the view. You can detach any of the three panels by putting your cursor over the icon to the right of the panel and clicking, and that will allow you to move it and resize it to meet your specific needs. Materials are always made in advance and are downloadable from your account on the ada-audio.org website. And for those of you in the webinar room, you can follow along with today's presentation. And at this point, we're going to get to our speaker, Michael J. Sullivan, who is an ADA consultant in law enforcement. You can find Michael's full bio on the www.ada-audio.org website to get more information about Michael's background. And with that, I would like to welcome Michael and turn the session over to him. So welcome, Michael.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you all about this. What I would like to do is talk about the ADA and law enforcement and the issues, but give you some sort of practical guidance on how it unfolded I was a sergeant with the San Francisco Police Department. In the last 17 years of my career, I was the ADA coordinator. So what I'd like to do is give you some practical ideas of how this works and how law enforcement in general works. I'm not going to speak a lot about corrections because that's an entirely whole other topic, but a lot of these issues are the same in terms of training and recognition of people with disabilities and how to go about as an ADA coordinator or someone interested in working with your law enforcement agency, how to go about actually getting some of these things into play, how to approach that, and also talk about some of the issues that are very important when training police officers. I say police officers, and it's deputy sheriffs, correctional staff, any law enforcement. So what I'd like to do is just kind of begin with some basic overview of people with disabilities and kind of set the stage and context of how they come to the attention of people in law enforcement and just what some of those issues are and the particular kinds of accommodations that may occur along the way. And really want to focus on some training and issues that are, you know, that are unique to law enforcement that will help you understand how to go about conducting some training. So the next slide is where does it all start? As you all know, this shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. This is the basic individual with disability denied access. We know a lot about access. I mean, thinking just basic of can you get into your local police station, your local sheriff's department to make a police report or an incident report or ask questions, just some simple things. So this applies across the board to all aspects of law enforcement in jails, prisons, court holding facilities, district police stations, sheriff's substations. Any facility where the law enforcement is located, this applies, as you all know. Say, I know I'm preaching to the choir a little bit here. On the next slide, I think this is my general philosophy about all this. One of the things about law enforcement is we enforce laws. And we enforce things, so this is concept of enforcement. So since we don't enforce it, we comply. And when we comply, we're accessible and useful to and usable by people with disabilities. That idea of getting law enforcement to understand there's no actual code book to open up here to see what you're supposed to do. We all know about the regulations in Title II, but it's a great idea to get that clearly across, because I'll talk a little bit about this later and how law enforcement gets called on to sometimes settle disputes. You've all seen in the newspaper and YouTube and TV all the time about people with service animals being turned away and the police arriving to intervene in the dispute and not necessarily knowing what to do. And it's not a failure on the part of the agency. If they've never been trained or if there's no policy on how to handle those types of calls. This is also understanding how people with disabilities come to the attention of law enforcement and how they're going to meet them and why it's important to understand about compliance and having policies in place. And I'll mention, talk a little bit about some kinds of policies. The next slide, specific impacts on law enforcement. It's everything. Stations I mentioned earlier, community rooms, a lot of agencies, particularly in the use of a lot of the model community policing model, will have community rooms specifically that are opened up to allow any members of the community to hold meetings and also to hold meetings that are put on by law enforcement agencies. So that idea of physical access, you know, is there accessible parking? Is there an accessible path of travel? Is the entry accessible? No thresholds, no steps. Is there another entry to be used to get in? Is it properly signed to get into it? In San Francisco, at one point, we had small kitchens, little kitchenettes that were allowed for the community to use. They were closed at one point and then reopened, so we had to go back in a number of them and make them actually accessible and retrofit them. So those kinds of things, you know, assisted listening devices and things, you know, we'll talk about permits, license, policy modifications. A lot of law enforcement agencies issue permits. And this goes kind of hand-in-hand with event planning, festivals. One of the things that happens with police officers, it'll be at a festival that's been permitted by your local city, county, township, whatever. And as you know, with food vendors and other things, things were made accessible, clear path to travel along sidewalks, no mystery tables laid across or a table that have covering, or when a vendor gets there and starts stacking up things blocking the path to travel. One of the things that happens is that everyone turns to the police officer or sheriff that's standing around and providing security and asks them what to do and to fix it. So one of the things to consider in allowing for the permit is each of these parties involved in the festival under Title III all need to be accessible. So having the vendor who's responsible for the overall, the festival coordinator, provide a simple little 3x5 card with contact information so that, for example, the electrical cables that are run across the sidewalk are now missing the, or never got on there, the cover. Then that covers the cables that will allow people using chairs to go across them. There's someone that officer can call on the scene at that moment to get and fix it. So it's a simple thing. It's not something that we're going to enforce because law enforcement's not there to enforce that. But again, having that option, having that information. Emergency planning, I don't think I need to speak about that. That's just absolutely critical. There's, you know, a lot going on about emergency planning and absolutely including people with disabilities in that planning so they understand it. And operational calls for service, all those things that every law enforcement agency does from the time the phone rings at 911, the 911 dispatcher, you know, is it an accessible direct connection to people using that are deaf, hard of hearing, all the way in providing that information to the officers arriving on the scene, to the follow-up investigations, to the interviews, to meeting with people, and proceeding through that entire case start to finish. Next slide. Can we hit the next slide? Hello?
They're advancing the slides in the webinar room, Michael.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble with the connection, sorry. So this is just a few kind of cherry-picked cases and settlement agreements. There are a lot on there. One thing that's great is if you go to ADA.gov and look at the settlement agreements in Project Civic Access, particularly if you're an ADA coordinator that has responsibility with law enforcement agencies, and kind of take a look at the settlement agreements and what's being written in those and see what how they pick with law enforcement agencies, whether it's physical access or providing procedures and policies and training around deaf and hard of hearing, but it'll give you a good idea. Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, GSD, is the big case that made it all happen. It's the case that showed GSD, if you don't know, was an inmate who had a heart condition, wanted to participate in a program. He said no. And what basically the long and short of it in that case was that Title II does apply and to everything. And that's where you need to be cognizant of. Barnes versus Gorman was an interesting case. It started out as a gentleman in a wheelchair, was at a bar, got unruly, was transported during the transportation, and inappropriate transport was done. There were no tie downs, I believe. And he fell out of his chair and was injured. Again, I'll talk a little bit about transportation policies later, but that's another case in Title II. And just an example of a couple of things here. New York City Police Department in 2009 signed a settlement agreement to do training around deaf and hard of hearing and sign language interpreters and making modification of their policies and procedures to allow for that. You can look at that settlement agreement online at ada.gov and kind of pick out where those things are going. Alameda County Sheriff's Department here in California, in a correctional setting, about visitation, use of TTY, deaf inmates, and these things are all in play at the different levels of law enforcement, you know, from state prisons to county jails to local law enforcement. And the Portland Police Bureau, which is in the process of completing a settlement agreement with the Justice Department. Now, this was not filed as an Americans with Disabilities Act case. It was filed under another provision than law enforcement by the Justice Department. But I would really recommend reading the settlement agreement here. It's online about this case in particular because it talks about training around mental illness and crisis intervention teams and setting them up and how they're going to work, how the training is going to occur. Yeah, there was a long history there, but it's a very good synopsis of working with people with mental illness and law enforcement and crisis intervention teams, which are originally started in Memphis, Tennessee, and they're specially trained police officers, sheriff's deputies who respond to calls involving a person with mental illness and working through that call with them, and they have a level of expertise. So that's those are sort of the highlights in setting this up, but I think there's something that everyone can take a look at and get a basic idea. Next slide. So every year, the Bureau of Justice Statistics put out a report titled Crime Against Persons with Disabilities. And what they do is look at, there's the definitions of disability are different for the study, so, but just in general, what they're doing is taking a look and comparing people with disabilities as victims of violent crime, violent victimization as it's called in the report, to people without disabilities. And a couple of things in the 2009-2011 report talked about that people with disabilities have twice the rate of victimization of serious violent crime. Their rates are higher, females are higher, people with cognitive disabilities have the highest rate among people with disabilities. So it's important when you're looking at these statistics to realize that people with disabilities tend to be invisible and then become victims of crime. So it's important that law enforcement understands how people with disabilities, what the disability may have an effect. It may have an effect on their ability to be interviewed. It may have their effect on when they can be interviewed. So with some basic information here is this idea that people with disabilities, according to the statistics, have a higher rate of victimization. Next slide. This is just working backwards here to the 2008-2010 report. And what's interesting here is it still talks about having higher rates of victim of violence, say, victim of violent crime. But one of the, you know, the victims of assault and things like that. So one of the things here that's very striking to me about this is that about 9% of persons with disabilities use victim services agencies other than the police to report. There was an earlier report, I believe it was the 2007 study, and one of the things there in the 2007 study showed that a percentage of these cases were not being reported by the police, to the police, or followed up on. So there's a lot of reasons for that. But who knows? But when you look at the statistics and realize that people with disabilities are victims of crime, the idea about making law enforcement accessible is even bigger because you realize now that people with disabilities have to have the ability to make these reports, whether it's a police officer or sheriff's deputy coming to them and the proper follow-up, in the prosecution of the case, and then along the way, the entire system understands how how it works for a person with a disability and understanding what that disability may impact on their ability to participate in the case and other strategies to work around that to make sure the case does get followed up. The next slide. This was a study responding to victims of crime with disabilities. This was a study that was done by Portland State University. An excellent study a few years back. What they did is they talked to people with disabilities and talked to people in law enforcement. I helped participate in the focus groups of law enforcement. One of the things they found that people with disabilities, and this is reported in the study, is barriers to reporting abuse. It was interesting as you, so we'll go through these here a little bit. Well, what's interesting is if you think about these become accessible solutions, whether they're attitudinal solutions, whether they're physical solutions, or training solutions. But these are people with disabilities who are afraid to report or didn't know what to do. So again, putting out information, and I mentioned earlier about community policing. It's important in community policing to get out to the community, the stakeholders, people that are counting on the law enforcement agencies to have this information to understand who people with disabilities are. You know, cultural attitudes, as mentioned earlier, they're invisible, they're marginalized. People with disabilities are on the outside. They may be embarrassed because they, quote, allowed this to happen to them. Fear of not being believed is huge, that they fear because of their disability, that they have no credibility. And again, that's a huge training issue. Emergency support providers are not available. This is, happens too, where sometimes it may be the caregiver, maybe the suspect, that they have to remove the caregiver, arrest the caregiver for abuse. And the person with the disability is so reliant on that caregiver, and there's no emergency, so you remove, you know, the caregiver, and suddenly the person who has nobody to fall back on. So it's the idea of having an emergency response that law enforcement can call on the caregiver to come in and supplement or act in as needed and intervene while a more permanent solution is found. So people with disabilities may not report for that reason. There are, we mentioned lack of accessible resources. And this goes, blasphemy, I just want to jump to the no to call. It goes back to that 9% of getting out, law enforcement getting out to the community to nonprofit service providers and letting them know. For example, I had a case where a person who was deaf had their backpack stolen off their back, ran up behind him, grabbed the backpack, knocked him down. By the time he got up and looked around, the suspect was long gone. He went to a local nonprofit, reported that, they did all the standard stuff, called the bank, credit cards, did all the closeout. Was never reported to the police. About 6 months later, he's checking his bank accounts and starting to realize he'd become a victim of identity theft. And it's idea of that it was great, the nonprofit's wonderful, he was able to go there and get those things shut down, but the lack of follow-through with the police and making a police report creates a problem where the identity theft gets going. He had to come back and make a report, as most people require this for, you know, reporting things stolen or whatever. But there's also that lost time for law enforcement and not having that case right away. But again, this wasn't a problem of anyone doing or not doing, is that nobody really, the nonprofit folks never really thought about it as being a crime. This is also issues of landlord-tenant or coming across domestic violence and realizing it and understanding they can report that to the police and provide for accommodations along the way. Next slide. This is just further continuation of the information about barriers. You mentioned it into passing there about systems where the legal medical system isn't necessarily trained, or they don't have policies. Domestic violence cases, making sure that people with disabilities have access. The lack of coordinated response. This is that idea where you have maybe Adult Protective Services and the police and Sheriff's Department doing something, and maybe a couple of other social service agencies or others, in coordinating their activities and making sure that everyone is working on the same page, and also if accommodations be done, if those accommodations carry through. For example, obviously someone needs a sign language interpreter, that every step along the way that a qualified interpreter is provided so that they can access the system. Other fears, fear of losing their independence, fear of losing their custody of their children, those are strong fears. There's a lot of states still that they use. There was a study just recently done that showed a lot of states still look at the disability in relation to having, you know, custody of children and children and things. So those are all issues that are also helpful to understand for law enforcement, so that when they're at someone's home with a disability, that they understand that there's a lot of background issues and hesitancy. Talked about an abusive caregiver, but this also could be a family member. And again, if that's your support system, there's huge reticence to report it. This is that idea, too, of domestic violence, that circle of violence and the power position. It's a similar type situation there. So fear of backlash, the consequences of calling the police, that something's going to happen to them. If it's a fear, there may be no basis in reality, but again, getting that information out to people with disabilities or the nonprofit service providers that are working with people with disabilities so that they can get that information out also. And also the fear of isolation is just not wanting to report because something's going to happen again. So when you think about it, you know, there's attitudes on the part of, really fears on the part of people with disabilities based on the study, that are an encumbrance or a hindrance to them contacting law enforcement. So again, that's an idea of law enforcement getting the message out and going out and letting people know what the real story is. So what, in the next slide, what are program services and activities in law enforcement agencies? You know, what does that mean? Do they even have them? You know, we all make arrests, and we write police reports or incident reports, but there's more to it. Just off the few of them that I picked out here that may or may not be in your jurisdiction, but just some ideas of things. Citizens academies, ride-alongs. This is when someone rides with the law enforcement agency to see what goes on. Those are not so popular. There's a new thing that I just saw a couple of weeks ago, an article called Tweet-Alongs, where a law enforcement agency was tweeting the activity of their officers over the course of an evening. Air programs, the drug programs, accessible materials, are they being offered to children with disabilities that are... there's a school in San Francisco, it's the deaf school. Children who are deaf go there and are integrated. But again, coming out and doing these programs, are they providing, you know, sign language interpreters and alternate format and materials, the thing to save safety awareness, you know, McGruff the crime dog, pamphlets, there's a lot of, you know, fairs where these theater and safe will show up and set up a booth and have information, you know, a neighborhood watch and those kinds of things. Again, are those materials accessible to people in alternate formats? Jail visitation, do visitors have access? If there's telephones, the counter heights, you know, the telephones or audio, all those kinds of things go into play. And on the flip side of it, for the inmates to allow, do they have visitation by family members with disabilities, or if the inmate has a disability, is the visitation area accessible? tip lines, you know, these anonymous tip lines, how are they handled? Is there a separate TTY line? Do the people answering the line know what a relay call is? Are they aware of what that means, how to take it? Traffic schools, an educational setting, victim witness programs to ensure that people follow up, that they have access to accessible features. Fingerprinting, a lot of computerized fingerprinting, but because of mobility impairments, may require the old-fashioned way of rolling fingerprints. There's an accommodation. Again, and this tweet-alongs kind of ties in with web-based police reports and web-based newsletters. Are they accessible, you know, on the web platform? Next slide. And this is something that I think is really important to understand when training law enforcement, awareness versus sensitivity. I'm sensitive and I feel bad. Can I go now? A lot of training, we're all familiar with it. You know, you have people put on gloves and try to pick things up to simulate mobility impairments. You know, Vaseline on the glasses to simulate low vision. You know, have someone sit, use a chair and roll over the doorway and find that the threshold to half inch and you can't get over it. And the person who's trying it goes, wow, that's bad, stands up and gets out of the chair and turns around and rolls it over to the next person. Can contrast that a little bit to specifically about law enforcement. There's nothing wrong with that, but there's this layer of law enforcement where it's behavior-based. So one of the things that is talked about here is this idea that a medical model versus the people model. One of the things that happens a lot with disability is people think medically. You know, you have intellectual disability, you have a mobility impairment, you're paralyzed, you're missing a limb. So this is sort of medical model kicks in. And one of the problems with that is if you're thinking along the lines of a medical model, you begin to diagnose. So when you're diagnosing, so for example, so let's say cerebral palsy. So you look at that and say, oh, this person has cerebral palsy. And what I read about cerebral palsy is they're supposed to be this way. And then you have that expectation that that's the way it's going to be. And like you said, you know, and autism. Not everybody's the Rain Man. In fact, the Rain Man is someone that law enforcement would come across as probably someone who's a missing person. So if you focus on the behavior, which is what police do, police officers, sheriff's deputies, whoever is in law enforcement, comes in, looks, and has their own checklist. You come in, you get a call, you arrive, you don't actually know what's going on. So the first thing is you size the people up in the room. Are they the good guy, the bad guy, suspect, witness, not sure, are they on drugs, not on drugs, are they focused, do they have weapons, and all the rest of that. And that all literally occurs in a thousandth of a second. And that's that whole presence where law enforcement stands there and they're standoffish. They're trying to figure out what's going on. So when they see that behavior and it's not clicking for them, it's not checking their box, they're not sure where it is, the key thing here is to get across that maybe the reason that behavior isn't what you think it is it may be as a result of a disability. It might be the disability really behavior that you're seeing that doesn't fit. So the training that goes on, a lot of training like sensitivity or interacting with people with disabilities or disability etiquette, you have to layer in how police people come to the police or law enforcement's attention. So it's not like, say, going to the counter at the local Department of Public Works to get your plan check and you're working through it and you do all the accommodations. What happens with police and police and sheriffs, law enforcement, we're trying to figure out what's going on here, and I need to know exactly what I'm looking at here and how it may affect what I'm about to do. So, and again, there's this officer safety component, which I'm going to talk about in more detail, that everything is done from that standpoint. So you have to understand that there's that reticence that everybody sees on the part of law enforcement is actually calculated on their part. So as an ADA coordinator, as we kind of progress here, if you keep this in the back of your mind, my basic tenet was this, in providing information to law enforcement and having policies and procedures in place. If you kind of throw this question out to yourself and think about, okay, it's 3:00 in the morning, it's Saturday, it's Christmas Eve, Saturday night, you have an officer, deputy sheriff, whomever, in the busiest intersection in your city or your town, and has a person with a fill-in-the-blank disability who needs a fill-in-the-blank accommodation, can that law enforcement member get that? And if the answer to that is yes, you have good policy, you have good procedures. If the answer to that is I don't know, hopefully at the end of this, you'll have some idea where to get started. Next slide. This slide is considerations for law enforcement. It's officer safety. It's why we do the things we do. That's what I was just talking about, that whole presence, that whole standoffishness. It's not being rude. It's really sitting back and waiting to see what's going on. You know, everything's based on safety. How do you approach someone? Where do you stand? Why do you move the way you move? How do you approach buildings? Why do you make people talk to you? It's all about observations and anticipating problems, and trying to stay away from those problems. So for example, here's evaluating behaviors. I was told the story, and it's a real good example of where training and a little bit of knowledge goes a long way. So in honor of Joe Friday, the names are changed to protect the innocent. And there's a couple who was at a dinner, and this was told me by the male partner here. So it's a man and a woman at a table in a local restaurant, both deaf, both signing, having a very animated conversation. He noticed that there were two police officers, one that was facing him, kept looking over their way, of course, ill. And he kept animating and looking in. His wife was very animated. And they were having a wonderful time. And the officer kept looking over, and his partner began to turn around and look. So the gentleman who was sitting here was getting a little worried as to why they were looking at him. So finally, a few minutes, the officer walks over. And apparently one of the people there just had limited hearing. It's still here. It was verbal. And the officer asked if everything was okay. And they said, yes, of course. And over the course of their discussion, a little education went on. The officer, being a police officer, observed this animated argument, what looked like to be an argument to him, went over because he was concerned that there may be an argument. It might be a defective balance case in the making. It might be something that's already occurred. He wasn't sure. That's what police do. If you don't know, you go find out. The good news was, once it was explained to him, he completely understood it and realized what he had observed was just two people having a regular conversation using American Sign Language. But he had a little bit of training and knew that. But the idea was, the deaf gentleman said to me, why did he come over? And I explained it to him, and he said, I never thought about that, that someone could interpret that animated, normal conversation with ASL as potentially a problem. So that's that idea that, again, also in educating the community and what the police do. But that's why police do what they do. And I'm going to make it easy for myself here and just say police, and I mean everyone. Next slide. You know, as you're thinking about training, you have existing tactics. Take those existing tactics, training, and modify them to people with disability. And I'll give you a little example in just a second here. There's no boilerplate to this. It's all fluid. Every person's unique. Every person with a disability is unique in their own disability. So it's good to discuss disability and the kinds of behaviors you might see, but really reinforce that idea. You know, I mentioned the Rain Man early on. Well, as you all know, the autism spectrum is just that. It's a spectrum. and I'll talk a little bit about some of those, some of the issues related specifically to examples of specific disabilities. Remember we were talking about etiquette training, sensitivity training, and that. The safety zone about retrains and false insecurity. One of the things that's important in training in law enforcement is, I mentioned, officer safety. You ever watch law enforcement officers, how they stand when they're talking to someone? It's different. They move differently. They act differently. There's a reason for that. They're staying out of the range of a punch. They're staying out of the range of a kick. You add some distance between you and that person, and there's increased time for that person to come at you or attack you. So that's all calculated. It's all called this, you know, there's the safety zone. It's the reach ranges. So people have mobility devices, for example. It's important to let officers know what mobility devices are and what they do. People with walkers used for other reasons, crutches are used for other reasons, and canes are used for other reasons. But there will come a time where someone may have to be searched or approached and asked to be patted down at full safety search, cursory search, letting officers understand that that safety zone that they've created, which is basically, if you think about it, arms and legs, is increased by the length of whatever that device is. So letting officers know, first of all, if you're going to search someone, sometimes it's very helpful to communicate to the person, I need to just give you a little quick search here. Could you put your cane down? And then they say, no, I really need it to stand. I really need it for balance. It's not something I can really do right now. Then you might just ask them, well, you can just sit down. Could you hand me a cane? Could you do something else? It's an idea of giving them some idea of plan B, plan C, and plan D. But the idea that these devices serve a purpose for the person with a disability and come up with some way of working around it. So I'll give you a real concrete example here on the next slide. I have a slide here, and I have to apologize, I'm having a computer problem, so I'm not sure it's up yet. But what you look when it comes up here, it's a diagram from an overhead view of a person using a chair, and it has a red zone in the back, front and the back. It's kind of a bad place to be standing. So if you think about modifying training and looking at existing tactics, is how do you approach someone in a wheelchair and provide the safety? And at the same time, thinking about etiquette or sensitivity and that idea that someone in a chair is looking up all day and their neck's up, how do you accomplish that? Now, I have seen videos for law enforcement where the officer pulls the chair up and sits directly in front of a person in a wheelchair. Well, the problem with that is if you're going to train law enforcement officers, I'll give this as a caveat now, if you show anything that compromises officer safety, you will lose them. They will stop listening to you. Safety is a huge, huge thing. I can't stress that enough. I see it's here. So if you think about this, and you've probably seen enough police shows on TV, if you think about what a wheelchair is, it's a mobility device. It's mobile. It has four wheels. What's the similar type of thing officers are familiar with? It's a traffic stop. How do you approach a car? How do you accomplish searching someone in a wheelchair while at the same time maintaining safety? So what you do, you approach from the side. You learn about how to search someone when they're standing and how to do a cursory search, you know, whether it's, you know, you divide the body into quadrants and search quadrants. You could do the same thing. Can someone come out of the chair? Sometimes people can, depending on the disability. You can ask them. You can have them potentially shift in their chair and reach underneath. You know, train the officers to be aware of medical devices, whether it's urine bags, catheters, pumps, other things. And do that and move around. The etiquette part about not, you know, handing or leaning on someone's chair. Well, one of the things is to actually have a light touch or hold to one of the handles so that you can feel the telegraph of movement. Have them turn the power off to the chair. If it's a power chair, have them put the brakes on. Same idea. And if you want to maintain that etiquette but you don't want to sit down, you can accomplish two things here by taking several steps back, which, as I mentioned before, about the space between you and the injury or potential attack. take a few steps back. That also allows the person to drop their hair and have that eyes have drop sorry drop their head, have that eye to eye contact. Now, if things have settled down and everything's good, and you want to sit on a chair, fine. But that initial contact, until an officer is sure that it's safe to proceed, back off, do that, and work your way backwards. But again, being aware of training, how do I accomplish the search, how do I accomplish the approach, that's the law enforcement side, and then the etiquette or sensitivity side is how do I accomplish letting this person drop their head, have eye-to-eye contact. Well, I can do that by taking several steps back, or as things settle down and I'm confident that things are good, if I want to, I can sit in a chair. But again, it's an idea of safety. The next slide, a few things about officer safety. Continue on that theme a little bit here. Training officers understand about handcuffing, you know, the range of motion. You know, you may need to use an extra set of cuffs. You may need to do flex cuffs instead of the steel cuffs. You may have to handcuff somebody one, two separate handcuffing someone in a wheelchair. We had ADAPT came to town in 2001 and had 4 days of demonstrations about Laguna Hospital, train the officers about how to make the approach and understanding disabilities. Also at the time when arrests came up, if people needed to be handcuffed, to be aware of range of motion, joint laxity, tightness. If someone's tightness, it may not be that they're resisting the handcuffing you. It may very well be that they've reached the limit of their motion. So a very simple thing is to ask, can you move your arms? You know, let me know. Simple thing like that. That where resistance may not actually be resistance, it may be the actual disability. The next slide, considerations for booking here. Booking is interesting. It's when they bring the body in and you're going to arrest the person who's under arrest, and they come to the jail and they're getting processed. What about wheelchairs? What about service animals? What about crutches, canes, walkers, those things? Or do you, your housing issues, is it a correctional issue? You know, on housing, you don't just put someone with a disability in a medical unit because you have nowhere else to put them. The right to phone calls. You have a TTY. These calls are can be monitored in a correctional setting. Something to think about. Transportation issues. You talked about the Gorman case earlier. This is an issue that if you're going to do transports, that you have an appropriate vehicle. Now, if the person can transfer from their chair, for example, into the back of the car, that's great. But you also need to recognize the officers, as I mentioned earlier, about handcuffing. Do they know they're going to have to take the cuffs off? I'm not a big proponent of lifting people. That could cause injuries to the law enforcement officer and to the person with a disability. But if you are going to go that route, train to learn how to lift. So that's something to think about. Also, there's the issue of weapons and being able to grab them, whether it's pepper spray or a taser or the actual firearm. But that's something about lifting people and guiding people that they have to be aware of. So the transportation issues, do you have the appropriate vehicle, the appropriate tie-downs? How can the person transfer on their own? And how are you going to handle if, say, you have someone in a power chair that is transported by ambulance to emergency room because they're a victim of an accident? Their ambulance crew is going to take them off their chair, put them on a gurney so they can work on them. How does that chair get out there? Who's taking that chair? That has to follow the body. So that something sounds very simple, but again, 3:00 in the morning, Christmas Eve, the ambulance rolls away and the police were there at the accident and they're doing all they're doing with the traffic accident collision investigation, and where's the chair going to go? Who's responsible for the chair? How are you going to get it up and reunite with that person? Caregivers, personal attendant, may or may not be involved. Again, I mentioned earlier that if they are the perpetrator, how is the person with the disability going to be cared for if they're reliant on 24/7 care or evening care, however that may be. Surface animals, as I mentioned, you know, does the animal go with them? Probably not. Allowing at the booking time to make the phone calls to get someone to take care of the animal. If it winds up going to animal PR control for the local shelter, that they are well aware that it's a service animal and that someone will be picking it up or that person will get to it, but that it's different and it needs to be treated differently, that it doesn't get considered abandoned on the way out the door and the person is coming to claim their animal and it's gone. Next slide. Support considerations for law enforcement. I talked about disability-specific issues. I mentioned cerebral palsy. One of the big things in training about cerebral palsy you always hear is, oh, someone with CP gets confused with being intoxicated. And they always say, no, be careful you don't arrest someone assuming that they're drunk and they're in cerebral palsy. But my question always is, well, how do you know if someone who has cerebral palsy, who had a beer and has an alcoholic breath, is not drunk? And what I always say is this. Every law enforcement officer in the world knows what a drunk is. Anyone who's not in law enforcement that's talked to a drunk for more than 4 seconds knows how a drunk talks. If you think about someone with CP and you think about the conversation we've been having with them, and again, this goes back to behavior, not medical model, they're looking at you, they're responding to you, they're interacting with you, their movements aren't deliberate. If you're asking for a driver's license or some form of ID or a piece of paper, their movements will be deliberate in how they obtain the driver's license out of their wallet or how whatever. So where a drunk can't do that, the drunk will drop their ID, will fumble with things. So it's an idea that you're looking at the behavior, and that behavior is deliberate. Simple question, can a blind person be a witness? Yes, if you think about it, but you need to train. You know, people have stereotypes and assumptions. I'll give you an example. A blind person walks down the street 3 blocks from their home every morning at 7 o'clock to get on the bus at the intersection a few blocks away to go to work. They follow their same path. It's the path they know. It's their wayfinding. You know, they know where the fire hydrant is. They know where the corner is. They know where the corner store is. They know where the coffee shop is. They move along to where their bus stop is. Well, one day they're walking along, and somebody grabs their wallet, purse, laptop, whatever it is, and takes off running. So the first thing you're going to think is, what did you see? Which is the normal question. Well, what they see is an interruption of their route. So if there's no crime scene contamination issues, you're going to get a statement from the person. Have them walk you the path. And as you're walking the path, you're going to identify the buildings go by, which may provide for witnesses, may provide for a camera, or it may provide, depending on where you are, that you walk by maybe the local flop house that is where parolees wait before they move on and find out that as they approach this doorway, they heard a door open and someone came out because they felt them come out. And that's when they felt their pack being grabbed and took off. And the person said something to them. They say, well, what did they say or what did they look like? There may be smells. There may be the fact that the person said something and the sound of their voice was right by their head, which would give you an indicator of height. So it's that idea that don't be confronted with, oh, a person's blind, I can't. Be creative. You know, slow down interviews, it's going to take more time. You know, autism is a big issue. You know, one of the things that signs of abuse when you go to a house, it may be doors that are locked on the wrong side. It's to keep the scriptures and the child from wandering away. You know, depending on the behavior of the child, there may be a loud TV on that you're going to turn down because you're trying to hear, and you realize that when you turn it down, the child backs up, and the parent says, could you please turn the TV on, because that helps them. This idea about, you know, coming in and seeing the child injured, well, it may be because of self-stimulating behavior, that maybe they're rubbing. Those are things, you know, you don't assume immediately that there's abusive parents. But again, still evaluate what you see in terms of behaviors that might be connected with autism and behaviors that may indicate that someone or injury that may indicate abuse. That idea of touching is always comes up. You hear a lot of don't touch, you know, someone with autism, they don't like to be touched. Well, a problem for law enforcement and for other first responders, including fire, ambulance crews, is that sometimes we do have to touch. And when that may set the child off, they may react. But again, it's that idea of, as I mentioned earlier about handcuffing, same idea here. If you train and people, officers, understand about autism and touching, that they understand that when you touch them, you may get a flight or fight response. You may get a reaction. The child may lash or fight back or do something. They're trying to avoid the touch. Understanding that means you understand that they're not fighting you. They're not resisting. This is a behavior related to the disability or symptom, whatever you like to call it. And then the way they know. Intellectual disabilities, you know, interviewing people that they're victimized by others. I had an ADA coordinator call me from another town that drug dealers were having children with intellectual disabilities, teenagers, delivering drugs for them. Because they figured if they got caught, nothing would happen. So those kinds of things and that need to please, all those things go into play. That when you're interviewing someone who may have been a witness to an accident, have them stand where they saw him. Have them tell you the story and let it flow. You know, not and ask these open-ended questions and make it more of a narrative. And the biggest thing here, the huge, huge thing, is just listening, letting people tell their stories, slowing it down, understanding that it's going to take a little bit longer. I'd like to spend the next slide and spend a little time here on the deaf and hard of hearing issues, and particularly working with sign language interpreters in a law enforcement setting. As you all know, that you need a sign language as part of effective communication, and one of that is providing an American Sign Language interpreter for someone who requires sign language as a means of communication. Whether you need to get the sign language interpreter, because again, if you point back to the settlement agreements, it'll give you some idea there. But it's the time and the complexity and nature context of the interaction. Writing a traffic ticket. You can do notes, plenty of information there. But what I always train is this. As you're building your case, as you're doing your interviews, as you're figuring out who's who, you know, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, who's the aggressor, who's not the aggressor, you know, in order to make that case, because again, ultimately you're looking at getting a prosecution, so if you have a victim who uses American Sign Language, you want to pay attention to getting a sign, in my view, getting as early as possible and getting accurate information, making sure that they're qualified interpreters, making sure that they understand, you know, how to sign and interpret. We required medical legal qualification. Fortunately, the organization we used had them on, which is great, because if there's a sexual assault, it's very helpful to have some sign language interpreters with a medical background to work through that. Understanding that having law enforcement members who, quote, know sign, they're not qualified to interpret, it's the same problem that gets created when you have someone who speaks Spanish that's not really fluent, and then you make your case, and then you find out when you get to court that the information's bad because it was misinterpreted or mistranslated. So the idea of qualified interpreters, because ultimately, as law enforcement, we're preparing a case to go to court. We want it to stick. The next slide, nothing really new. Primary consideration of the individual, but I want to stress a little bit here about the use of family members and a disability. Family members being requested under the new regulations. It talks, there's some discussion about family member or an adult requesting another person. Again, this is the unique part about training in law enforcement. Take a domestic violence case. You arrive on the scene. There's an aggressor, there's a victim, there may be a child there, another family member who signs. Not a problem saying to them in that initial or exigent emergency time, what's going on here and who's hurt. That way you figure out, you know, is there someone hurt in the back? Is someone bleeding? What's the nature of the injury? But then as that moves on, you're going to probably, if you can't use notes, you know, on screen, whatever you're going to do on a computer and communicate, you're going to need to get that sign language interpreter in there because you're going to base the case. The other side of the coin is, unless you're fluent in ASL yourself, you have no idea what you're being told. Just like, I do not speak Spanish, so when I have someone come in, I'm relying on it that they're telling me what's actually being said. So that idea, once everything's settled down, you got it locked down, injuries are being taken care of, the scene's under control, I would get a sign language interpreter in there to work along with you in developing the case. The next slide, a little bit more, you know, the use of notes is great. Use those notes. There may be issues of them, you know, becoming evidence. They're part of your notebook. Those are law enforcement specific issues. But also, something that comes up in work that I did is name signs. People in a lot of community that I worked with knew people only by their name signs. So that's important that someone, that you train your officers, that someone may give you a name sign and what that means and how do you go find out about that. You know, there may be other, you mentioned the nonprofits earlier, you may be able to help identify somebody by their name sign. One thing that surprised me when I did community outreach that just also bummed me out a lot was the people who were deaf through the police. And it made perfectly good sense that, you know, they were afraid they're going to be shot because they didn't hear. That they're going to, you know, try to pull out an ID or the name to want to communicate and come up to the officer immediately. So that's why in training police officers that, again, the behaviors, if someone's not responding, not hearing, it might be because they're deaf. It might be because they're hard of hearing. It also might be just because they don't want to listen to you. But watch the behavior. Maybe flash the light in their eyes, get their attention that way. But that idea of understanding you have to get their attention and that they are afraid of the police, that just really shocked me. So we did community outreach. That's huge. Get out there, talk to the deaf community. Tell them what police practices are. Tell them what we do, what we expect, what happens when the police come. The idea of handcuffing. The idea of shackling someone in the front, behind their back and removing their ability to communicate. Important that officers get trained, that they understand that. Handcuffing behind the back is a huge safety issue. If an officer wants to handcuff in the front, that's their call. It also allows the person to be able to get a hold of you, grab at things, combat. But training by telling the police officers and sheriffs, if you're going to handcuff someone who's deaf behind their back, you've removed their ability to speak. So if you have the ASL interpreter on scene, you can explain that to them, whether you can do it to notes, however you want to do it. But then if you're going to interview the person or interrogate them later, you have to take a look at how you're going to accomplish that by removing the handcuffs. If they're, you know, in a correctional setting, if they're prone to violence, you're probably going to be shackled you know, you could use wrist shackles or waist shackles and extend the length of them to allow that range of signing, kind of that zone between the top of your head and, you know, your waist, you know. But again, those are issues to make later. But that idea of letting them know the needs of a person who's deaf, that you're handcuffing them, is effectively the same idea as putting tape across their mouth. If you know that, it's like the thing I said about autism. Sometimes you have to touch people who have autism that are going to react to that. But knowing that that reaction and what it is based on they don't like to be touched, not that they're resisting. And the handcuffing is stop the panic ahead of time by telling the person, letting the person know, however you need to do that, that I'm going to, we're cuffing you behind, but, you know, we're going to go to the station, there'll be an interpreter there, we'll interpret later, we're, you know, whatever it is, but again, a little bit of information. Next slide, I've spent a little time here talking about working with the sign language interpreter and in a law enforcement setting, where it can be a little different. We have interrogations and we have interviews. Give the Miranda warning, you give to the person, you know, training the interpreter. So, for example, we'll see it on TV, the interview room, making sure that the investigator or the officer conducting the interview or an interrogation in that case clearly understands that the interpreter will be signing everything that goes on in that room, and that they may have to set the room up a little differently because of light sources. I'm a proponent of videotaping anything like that because it creates a great record when you go to court. But again, those are issues you're going to have to talk to the local prosecutor about and local law enforcement as to whether the interviews are videotaped at all. And those are more procedural things, but this idea of training your investigators to understand how the interpreter works, to understand they may ask follow-up questions, they may ask clarification. You know, we use a lot of jargon, even though they're not going to know about. Also, in training during the interview, to understand that nodding doesn't mean yes to your question, that there's a lag time between the interpreting and the questions you're asking, and misreading body language, the idea of nodding or agreement, or raising their hands up, which could indicate this, maybe the sign of that they don't understand what the interpreter's saying, and you might take that another way. So, and also in talking to the person, not through the interpreter, and being clear with the interpreter what the expectations are, meet them outside the interview room, tell them what you're doing, why you're there, what you're going to be doing, and ask if they have any questions. Another thing is when training the interpreters, they may not want to be involved in whatever organization you're using. Could just be a philosophical issue. It could be they're very uncomfortable with that setting. We had on call sign language interpreters, a male and a female, and a third in case there was some issue. But having a male and female interpreters available can be huge, particularly in sexual assault cases. Also, in case the person doesn't want to interpret for that person in particular, they may know them, or they find that they are not great in interpreting with them, that there's someone who's better in interpreting for them. Also, understanding that the written statements may be written in non-standard English, which is ASL. They may write in ASL, and it's not a sign of intelligence. It's a sign that they write differently. Or, you know, articles are missing, verbs may be different, but the information's the same. But understanding that when they're firsthand and you read it, it's like, what is this? And I always try to equate it is when I train officers with the statement, it's not quite clear. It's the same idea as if, you know, you have someone who has a heavy accent, you just listen a little harder. So when you're reading the statement, if you think about what it's saying, it works and it makes sense to you. And you can also use the interpreter to ask clarifying questions. Next slide, I just kind of touch on a few reasonable accommodation examples. Sorry, I'm going real fast here, but I want to make sure we get some things in. just some things, simple things like providing documents by mail, but the investigators going back and forth, or even the officers will have email, you know, providing someone with the witness form or victim witness information. You know, something simple, you know, the 3 o'clock in the morning example, someone with low vision needs a larger printout on a form, stick it over to the photocopier and blow it up and come bring it back and forth until they can read it. You know, reading or filling out forms for them is very possible. One of the things that comes up there, came up early on, was Grissom because of the lack of a better damage to their hands that had been burned, received a traffic ticket, but could not sign the promise to appear. So what we did is came up with a policy that said very simply, if you cannot sign the promise to appear because of a disability, explain to the person that this is not an admission of guilt. You have to show up on the 15th and the 4th floor for traffic court. They acknowledge that. And then write an incident report or a police report that says, you know, I stopped Mike Solomon. He could not sign because of a disability. He acknowledged that he will be there on this date and that date. I don't know where about other states, but in California, if you refuse to sign the ticket, you can be arrested. So the refusal is not a refusal to sign the ticket. It is unable to because of a disability. And the acknowledgement that they will show up when they're supposed to, when they're signing for a promise to appear. You know, meet them in the lobby. We have a lot of district police stations that are some of the older stations, pretty expensive to, you know, do the drop in the counter for the accessible counters. And there are also small lobbies and other issues of physical limitations. So a simple modification is, person with the disability is there and you need to go out in the lobby and do the interview or fill out the forms or take the police report, go out in the lobby. Very simple thing. You know, follow-up information in the report. People, because of medication, wouldn't be available in the morning, so the investigator gets the case and starts calling at 8 o'clock in the morning and nobody's answering. You know, information about what's a good time to call. Also, these are going to be issues about, for follow-up, what are the limits your agency wants to put in about disability information in there. Do you want to just say a person has a disability, here's the follow-up information, how do you want to handle that? Maybe important to the case, maybe important to the follow-up. Another real simple, like sort of hands-on, you know, the 3 o'clock in the morning example, what do you do when technology is literally not available to you? The next slide, it's a very simple thing that anybody can take out a piece of paper and do in a matter of seconds, is a list of ABCs, the numbers 0, 1 through 10, and the words yes and no. You can conduct an interview until you can get whatever age you may need, but that initial information about a victim of crime who has a speech impairment that is worsened because they're now panicked, they're scared to death, they're talking faster because they've just been the victim of a crime, and you can't understand them, and you told them you can't understand it, and they're too nervous to write, or whatever it is, a real quick whip out piece of paper, and they can answer questions. It'll be a little slower, but you can get that basic information by having a point in answer to your questions. And remember, I mentioned earlier about someone with CP that you may not understand, can point to these and get you quick suspect information, direction, kind of vehicle, you know, yes or no questions, and get that information very quickly out there, particularly crimes that just occurred. And then as things settle down, you can find a more permanent solution to that. The next slide. This is the role of the ADA coordinator, which I'm sure you're all waiting for. Credibility. If you're going to train with law enforcement, get a law enforcement train, somebody in the training academy, whoever does their training, to work with you. Because it's very important to the credibility that you have information about disability, but the law enforcement officer is going to have in the training, is going to have how to apply it to law enforcement, how to make it work, how to make it understandable, work within existing policies, those kinds of things. So it's great credibility. You know, the big thing is we get tired of everybody's telling how to do your job. It's not about how to do your job. You're already probably doing some of these things but didn't know it. This is going to make it easier. There's just some tools in your toolkit to go out there and work with people with disabilities and putting together a case, doing interviews, general questions, and making it all work. You know, and who are people with disabilities in your community? Who are they? Obviously, they're victims of crimes. And obviously, based on the study that was done in Portland, people with disabilities may be reluctant to come forward. So who are they? Who are they in your... What groups can tell you about that? Centers for Independent Living, you know, deaf groups, social organizations. Find out who they are. You know, how are they coming to the attention of the police? Are there people preying on people with disabilities? Are there members of the disabled community who prey on other members? As hard as that sounds to believe, I've had a few cases like that. Describe how people with disabilities want what they want the police to know. What is it that, I think it's hugely important that people with disabilities tell police officers what it's the me. This is what I want you to know about me. I'm not this disability, but here's what I need you to know when you're working with me or talking to me. These are the things, it's the behaviors that I talked about earlier on that as a law enforcement officer you're going to see. You know, to go out and talk to the disability community, tell them who you are, what you're doing. You know, I mentioned the nonprofits, going out and educating them on identity thefts and crime, landlord-tenant disputes, domestic violence, so that they know and understand when to call the police, if they need to get the police involved. You know, go ahead and take a look at your existing policies. Most LA, I would say every agency has some sort of operating manual. You know, you see things about arrest, transportation, interviewing, the follow-ups. You know, look at maybe they did a self-evaluation. Maybe they did a transition plan. If they haven't, it'd be a great idea to at least get back there and look at those things and see if they truly are facilities that are accessible. Look at their overall training. Do you have disability training? Is it only on mental illness? Is it only on deaf, hard of hearing? Get everybody you want. It's about everybody, not just individual disabilities, because law enforcement touches everyone. And the big thing is my 3 o'clock example, make absolutely sure that anything that's put into place as a policy or procedure is available 24/7, because it's going to be the person in the middle of the night that's going to need it, not the Monday through Friday 9-to-5 call, which is always the easiest, probably the easiest one to deal with. So just in closing here, I just wanted to go over some examples of some kinds of policies here, and then open up to questions. Just some simple things, service animal policy procedure. Service animal calls, we have a lot of those calls. You know, can you ask about disability? And the answer to that is this, for law enforcement only. If you're enforcing a law, like is in California, it's actually a misdemeanor to deny access to someone using a service animal, that is a misdemeanor. One of the elements of that crime, one of the things you have to set out to prove, is it said a person with a disability. So you have to ask what the disability is, because that goes to charging. If you don't have such policy or law to follow up on, what I always suggest is this. Is it your pet? If it's not a pet, the person with the disability is going to let you know that. And if you're still not clear, what does the animal do? And that should cover it. So that idea, that's where the Title III entities come in, and where the police get called to, you know, the restaurant because the person has a service animal, and the whole thing gets going and everybody's agitated and they come in. And training your officers to understand service animal calls is a big deal, particularly just for good policing because it is going to call for service, but also if there is a law in your jurisdiction. How to get auxiliary aids, again, 24/7, accessible meeting policies, community policing, inviting the public in. You know, we talked a little east of TTY and booking, how to obtain sign language interpreters, how to transport people with disabilities, multiple chemical sensitivities, environmental illness. Again, people get arrested. They come in to do interviews or reports if there's odor, smells, cleaning products, markers. And when someone tells you it's bothering them, believe them that it's real. It's not some made-up thing. Vehicle code enforcement, talked about signing the citation, sidewalk violations, you know, blocking the sidewalk so people won't kill the path of travel, you know, having some policy about siding and towing. The disabled placard, do you tow the vehicles? Do you leave the vehicle in place? Because we found that sometimes when the vehicle is towed, the person had extra batteries in their car, and the car is gone because it was illegally parked. So things, you know, prescription drugs used by detainees, do they keep the medication? Do they move on? How do you handle drugs, particularly in a correctional setting, and making sure they have access to proper medications or medications that they're taking and are on a schedule? Segways, do you have local rules against segways? How are you going to find out about that? How are you going to enforce that? How are you not going to enforce it? What is a Segway? What is another mobility device? Are they allowed in transit malls? Not allowed in transit malls. The regulations talk about how to identify that, have a policy about that. And event permit conditions, we talked about that earlier, about having law, you know, requiring the people putting on the event to have access information available for law enforcement so they can find the right person to get it fixed. So, I guess we can open it up to questions now.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Mike, for that information. I'll quickly give instructions again for our participants in the webinar room. Go to the participant list and select the Great Lakes participant. Right-click on Great Lakes, and you'll see the option to submit a private message to us. If you're using assistive technology, screen reader users, use the F6 key until you get to the participant list. Once in the participant list, arrow up or down until you find the Great Lakes participant. Again, right click and you'll be able to submit a message. And then I will ask Saeed to come and give instructions to our participants on telephone on how they can ask questions at this time.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone.
And while we're waiting for questions, Michael, I want to quickly go back to your service animal example on the last one and just make sure that folks are clear on this so we don't, you know, a lot of service animal questions. When you were talking about, you know, getting into, you know, the person's nature with regards to service animals, you were talking specifically about enforcing the California law that, you know, where businesses don't allow a person with a disability from bringing their service animal into the business with them, you know, where that asking about disability is appropriate in terms of enforcement versus, you know, the limitations and the limitations and the two questions that can be asked by state and local government or even by businesses in terms of, you know, is it a service animal? And if it is a service animal, what task or work does the animal perform?
Right. Just to make it really clear, if your state or local jurisdiction does not have a law ordinance to be enforced, you know, whether it's a misdemeanor or an infraction, law enforcement is the same as everybody else. They do not get to ask that question. So the idea, if they're enforcing a law, then they're specifically used looking for what's called the elements of a crime. But again, that's absolutely a law enforcement issue if they're in the process of enforcing an actual statute. So I just want to be clear, it doesn't change the rule about anything about asking that's unique to law enforcement while doing enforcement.
Right. Okay, excellent. Saeed, do we have any questions on the telephone at this time?
I'm showing no one in the queue at this time.
Okay, well, we've got some questions from our folks participating in the webinar room. And first question wants to know how officers are trained to react to a person who tries to use their mobility device as a weapon. And, you know, what would be the training or protocol for someone that attempts to use a mobility device such as a cane or walker at the officer?
Well, it would be the same as any other situation. So it becomes a weapon at that point. And again, as I talked about earlier in training, there's an idea about creating that extra distance so someone's reach could be 6 feet with a cane, for example. So what that gets down to is very basic agency's use of force policy. You know, maybe they may use pepper spray, they may use the baton to strike it away. Whatever the rule is locally, and someone's using a cane, it becomes a weapon at that point. So that's where it's important also to understand in training police officers about the approach, recognizing the extended reach and modifying their approach to that so that maybe that situation doesn't create itself.
Okay. Excellent. And then another question from the webinar platform. Asking for best practices that folks in the disability community can use to advocate with their police department to participate and engage their officers in training on how to interact and deal with people with disabilities.
Hopefully there's an ADA coordinator in your jurisdiction, but if not, if you go directly to whether it's the sheriff or the chief of police and whether independent living, get a community group coalition together, talk about what the issues are and present them. And you probably have some solutions to those problems. And again, that was a credibility, that issue about partnering with the police or the sheriff or whatever law enforcement agency you're dealing with, so that the information you have can be tweaked to fit that setting. And I'm a big proponent, you know, community policing, that community groups come to the local law enforcement and have a sit down and talk about these issues. And again, another great source is ADA.gov with the settlement agreements. It'll give you some pretty good idea of what's kind of going on out there.
Right, from the other perspective, then from the law enforcement perspective of reaching out, you know, to the disability community, you talked about, you know, reluctance of victims with disabilities, coming forth, or even witnesses to crimes, reluctant to come forward, and that's not necessarily unique to the disability community. There are other communities for other reasons, whether it's legal status, that are sometimes wary of law enforcement. And so from the police perspective, are there techniques that are used to reach out to other communities that like to keep the police at arm's length that you have used or that you've consulted on that would be effective reaching out to the disability community?
I think one of the biggest groups to help you do that is independent living centers. They have people, it's getting to them first as a law enforcement agency and going out to them, because I think what happens if you think about a lot of information that bombards us about, you know, reporting and domestic violence and any number of things, it's done through mass media, And I think people with disabilities get missed, not intentionally, but it's just not thought of about making that second level. And independent living centers are going, as they talk about disabled community partnering police, one of the things that I found very effective for me when I was with the police department was using the independent living center and the hearing society and disability rights groups and others to say, can I come to your meeting? Can we talk? Can we partner? Can I come to and talk about what the police do and get that connection that way? Plus, they're a great source of information as things progress and finding out what's going on with the community. And it's a trust issue, as with any community. Everybody brings to the table their prejudice about people with disabilities and people with disabilities about law enforcement because of a bad experience. But I believe working through the independent living centers as one source is a great way to get your foot in the door and start that line of communication.
Right. And then you also talked about, you know, the ADA coordinator in those communities, those towns and counties where they're, you know, where they have ADA or disability advisory groups, that I would imagine would be another good place to work for the ADA coordinator and the disability community going both ways.
Absolutely. You know, mayor's disability councils, things like that, city councils, you know. I think for the years I've been doing this, that I don't think it's on people's radar so much about going to your police agency or your law enforcement agency and saying, we want to help get some disability stuff going here. But I like the global approach. It tends to be, like I said before, very specific disability. But I like the idea of, I mean, it's about everybody. It's a civil rights law. Get everybody to the table. It's about, as I said earlier on, about not enforcing but complying and get that line of communication started.
Right. And the next question from online, and then after that we'll check with Saeed to see if there are any questions by phone. But this has to do with the video remote interpreting. They revised the Department of Justice regulations that went into effect back in March of 2011. Now contain specific there are specifications that must be met if a covered entity, if a public entity is using video remote interpreting as its means of communicating with someone that's deaf or hard of hearing. So you know that can certainly be used when someone is coming in to fill out a report, or even I guess when if someone is being interviewed as part of a prosecution or as part of the expiration of a criminal act. But do you have any, you know, from your perspective in your years in law enforcement, Mike, the use of video remote interpreting versus using a qualified interpreter in person for, you know, something that may be more in depth if you're, you know, questioning someone as part of it, you know, they're a suspect.
The technology's great. I think it's wonderful, but it's, in my view, is not a substitute for an actual person signing. Because it's a great, you know, putting them, for example, in district stations where someone come in, make a counter report to whatever they need to do, have the video relay interpreter service there, and you can go back and forth, take care of the report, do simple things. But one of the things to be aware of about the face-to-face interpreting is that, take that example I gave earlier about the deaf couple at dinner. If they went into a district police station to make a report about that their window was broken on their car, and the officer is doing the report and video relay and starts to realize that there may be a domestic violence thing going on here or is suspicious of that, that's where you want to get a live interpreter because you're going to separate people. You also have crime scenes to go to, follow-up victims with hospitalization, and you want to keep that interpreter with them along for the continuity and the chain of custody of evidence and those kinds of things. So relay service stuff is great. I would also check with the relay folks just in case you do use them for interpreting in a criminal case where there's an interview or an interrogation? Do they understand? Are they medical legal certified? Do they understand they may be subpoenaed to court? You know, things about notes. And those are things to talk with your district attorney and local law enforcement investigations about how to utilize that. But I'm all for that. The relay service, video relay is great, but recognizing that you still will need to do face-to-face, real-life person standing there and moving about because it can be very fluid.
Sure, sure. And then, Saeed, do we have any questions on the telephone?
We do have a question from Rick Edwards.
All right, go ahead with your question, Rick.
Thanks, dear. Mike, first of all, great information. I wish we had more law enforcement folk here, but my initial question was about service animals and when the service animal itself becomes disruptive or protective of the individual. You kind of addressed that already with the wheelchair issue. So if I can follow up with it, can you talk a little bit about disputes regarding parking situations where you've got folks, even sometimes folks with disabilities, arguing about the parking problem?
Just to clarify, is it the lack of spaces or just...
abuse where, you know, there's some questions to whether or not the parking placard is actually issued to the individual with a disability or this is grandma's parking placard or whether they're parking in access aisles, that kind of thing.
Well, I can talk about California because I know the law, so here, everyone who has a parking placard is issued an ID that goes along with it. And then for law enforcement, you can also run up the person's driver's license number, and it will tell you whether or not they have a placard. And the placard has a number, and it's to the person. And again, it's another issue of it is a vehicle code violation to misuse a placard, so the questions can be asked. And there are a placard doesn't give you carte blanche to park wherever you like. There's still tow-away zones. There's still fire hydrants in places that it's prohibited. A lot of that is education and making sure people understand it. And, you know, some entities have a unit that Parking and Traffic Authority in San Francisco has people who specifically go around following up on complaints and enforcing that. So those are things to look at and kind of tackle it and find out again in the training is that how do you find out if it's a real placard?
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate, again, your training. Very good.
Right, thanks for the question. Staying on the theme of accessible parking spaces, in the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, requires that where parking spaces are provided in parking lots, a certain number of them must be accessible spaces, but doesn't, you know, get into the enforcement that's left up to state and local levels. In your experience and your knowledge in California, what laws are on the books in terms of, do police have the authority, for instance, to, if they're called to come onto a private property, so at the shopping center, and, issue a ticket for a vehicle that's improperly parked?
Well, it's going to be driven by the vehicle code. So in California, you can, on a private lot, it's still illegal to park without the proper credential placard in a zone, so it can be taken off the parking lot. And California allows private property owners to have vehicles towed off and removed. There's also there can also be provisions in the codes for fines, because eventually you have to get your vehicle back. But it's a very expensive ticket in California to park illegally or misuse a parking placard, and it's also going to be a misdemeanor if you're using it to someone else's placard.
Okay.
Everyone's going to vary there.
from state to state, sure. Saeed, do we have another question on the telephone at this time?
I'm showing a question from Sheila Laurie.
Sheila, go ahead with your question, please.
Yes. A person in our group has a question. What would be some insights or a best approach to get the local authorities to enforce violations where people are parking or blocking the access aisle of accessible parks?
Well, first thing is to find, well, obviously you can't do that, so that should be a provision in your local vehicle code or state code about blocking the access aisle. But sometimes they find it, they may not really know it or it's a priority about calls and how to handle that. At some point, like I was saying before, about going to the local law enforcement and getting them to understand why that's a huge issue. A huge issue for someone using a chair that is now blocked and has to go out behind cars and potentially run over by a car backed up because the access aisle is gone. So I think a lot of it is just letting them know why it's important, because I don't think people without disabilities don't think about issues of mobility very often. You know, it doesn't seem to make sense. And it's very obvious to someone with a mobility impairment is not even on anyone else's radar. So that idea of going and talk to them and tell them we need additional enforcement, that's a problem. And also if there are particular areas where it's occurring on a regular basis, then they can target those areas.
All right, great. Sadie, if you could use that line, thanks. It sounds like, Mike D, there's another issue of having that dialogue, the communication between the disability community and law enforcement.
It's huge. It's just, as I said, when I first became the ADA coordinator in 1992, it was amazing to me the assumptions I had that everybody knew what was going on, and talking to the Deaf Community Center for Independent Living, like I said, I went out and talked to them and realized there's a lot of stuff that's just not happening, and the disabled community wasn't necessarily talking to us because, I mean, if you think about it, we've tried it before and nobody listened. You kind of get tired of sort of banging your head against the wall, so that get out there and talk. It's so much easier to just get this started and find out actually how easy it is to do this stuff. This is not rocket science.
Right. And we've got time for one last question from the webinar room, another service animal question. And, the person's asking, what happens if police are called because a service animal is identifying as a person with a disability with a service animal, and the police are called because the service animal is acting aggressively or jumping on persons at the, whether it's a private business or in a public setting. What type of protocol? What would be best practice for responding officers?
Here's a good the thing to remember is that, the ADA and the new regulations is really does a good job of laying out what you need to do. So, again, having a policy, how to approach the interview, is it your pet, what's the animal do so they understand what service animals are. Also, letting them know if you have particularly a local policy that allows, say, for comfort animals, that's understood. That the local, the county, or for example in San Francisco, they allow for that. Understanding that the animal, if it's the service animal, is being agitated and leaping at people, probably means that somebody's bothering the dog or doing something to agitate the animal because they don't behave that way. It truly can't be under the control, letting them know that if it has to be under the control of the person or someone the handler of the animal, if they can't maintain control, that if it comes down to where they have to exclude the animal, that the business owner, or whomever it is, has to understand that they have to make accommodation for that person to use the facility. My experience has been that when the animal is being agitated, there's a reason for it, and by training your officers to understand that the animals don't behave that way, some external thing is happening, to figure out what's bugging the dog, which is probably somebody doing something. And what you're doing there is you don't need to exclude the animal at that point. Maybe you need to go have a, well, I would say maybe, you need to go have a discussion with the person or whatever is causing the dog to be disruptive to knock it off or remove it.
Excellent. Well, we are at the bottom of the hour, and Mike, I wanted to thank you for just a tremendous amount of information and a great presentation that you provided to us today. So a great way to kick off the first ADA audio conference of the year. If you did have a question that we were unable to get to due to time constraints, you can reach your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232 or visit www.adata.org to find out where your regional ADA center is located. A quick reminder that today's session has been recorded and the audio archive will be available shortly, and that will be available on the ada-audio.org website. Coming up in February, we are going to take a look at, revisit the issue of pools. Everyone into the pool. A refresher on the requirements for swimming pool lifts. There was a suspension in the requirements for accessible means of entry and exit into and out of existing pools. That suspension ends on January 31st of 2013. And so in February, we will revisit that issue. You can get additional information and register for that session by visiting www.ada-audio.org. And if you have questions, you may contact us at 877-232-1990. Again, want to thank Mike Sullivan again on behalf of the ADA National Network for his time and energy in putting together today's presentation and then delivering it today and answering the questions that the folks had out there. So I want to thank all of you as well, participants, for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you in February. For those of you in the webinar room, simply close your browser to exit the webinar platform, and we will see you all next month. Good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may all disconnect and have a wonderful day.